It seems every sphere or even person has a different interpretation of the Randall cycle. Kind of confusing knowing what to do after hearing everyone's interpretation. Like, should I just be low carb or should I be like high sugar, or does it really matter and I just have to pick one?
General idea of the Randall cycle: when you are burning fat for fuel, you won't be able to use carbohydrates. And when you're burning carbs for fuel, you won't be able to use fatty acids.
With somebody who has higher body fat and maybe releasing more free fatty acids, does that mean that it actually may be better for them to have less of an intake of fats?
The Randall cycle really takes center stage is when metabolism and metabolic function is dysregulated, like what you see with obesity, type 2 diabetes, insulin resistance, fatty liver, etc.
Welcome to the Mike Fave Podcast. I'm your host, Ethan Wright, joined by Mike Fave. In today's episode, we are going to dive into the Randall cycle, aka the glucose and fatty acid cycle, and discuss whether eating carbs and fats at the same time will make you fat, whether eating carbs and fats at the same time will make you insulin resistant, and understanding how the Randall cycle can help you optimize your metabolic health. So to start, why don't we give a brief overview of what the Randall cycle is for those who don't know by now?
Yeah, so the Randall cycle, it's called, the other name for it, as you mentioned, is the glucose fatty acid cycle. And the general idea of the Randall cycle is that when you are oxidizing or burning fat for fuel, you won't be able to use carbohydrates. And when you're burning carbs for fuel, you won't be able to use fatty acids. So this has been, I guess, called upon or cited in multiple different dietary camps, the low-carb carnivore camps, and as well as the high-carb camps. It's become more in vogue now with the sugar diet stuff. It's been something that's been discussed heavily inside the bioenergetic sphere, because basically there's this perspective from it that, well, since you can't use both carbs and fats at the same time, then you're going to have to choose one substrate. So I'm going to have to go high carb, low fat, or low fat, high carb, or else I'm going to become insulin resistant, or I'm going to become fat, or I'm going to develop metabolic dysfunction. And I think there's just a little bit of a misunderstanding around how the cycle actually works. And I think an appropriate context needs to be put in place for understanding when this is actually happening and where this is happening. And it all boils down to happening specifically at an individual cell, not across the whole body in general. There are hormonal mechanisms that shift things in, like, across the board or to a large extent. But overall, the body the Randall cycle is talking specifically about an individual cell, and that will change that'll change the takeaways from this, and I think help to dispel some of the, I guess, the misunderstandings in the different spheres.
Yeah, it seems every sphere or even person has a different interpretation of the Randall cycle. Like, even in anticipation for this week and recording the podcast and everything, I was watching different health people kind of discuss the Randall cycle, and it's kind of confusing, like, knowing what to do after hearing everyone's interpretation. Like, should I just be low carb, or should I be like high sugar, or does it really matter and I just have to pick one, or is like too much of, you know, both a problem? Do I have to, you know, separate fat in certain meals? And it's a whole mess of things. And so one point that you just mentioned that I think is actually lost in a lot of the cases is that it is happening at the individual, like, cell basis. Because I've heard you on other videos discuss that, like, even within the same tissue or organs or whatever, like, a certain cell can be oxidizing fat and a certain cell can be oxidizing sugar, right?
Yes. Yeah, so you have basically at one cell, one time. So in one given unit of time, and you have an individual cell, that cell is either going to be using carbs or fats. It's not going to be using both. It's not going to be turning both to ATP through mitochondrial energy production or through oxidative phosphorylation. It won't happen. What will happen is you can have a cell, let's say a muscle cell, that can be using fatty acids right now, and then it could be switching to using glucose a second later, depending on what's happening contextually in the body. And then across the whole body, you can have your muscle tissue be using fats while you're at rest, and your central nervous system, like for us doing this podcast, our muscle tissue could be using fats while our central nervous system could be using the carbohydrates for neuronal function. So you basically have a circumstance where across the body, you can have different tissues using different substrate simultaneously. It's just within an individual cell, you can only be doing one or the other. And even within a specific organ or tissue, you can probably have some cells within that organ using carbohydrate, whereas other cells are processing and utilizing fatty acids. So that's where I think the biggest misinterpretation comes from, that because people tend to think, well, I can't use both at the same time, and they forget the context in which that's happening. Then they just apply it to the whole body. And then that's where you get these takes of, I'm either going to have only high carb meals or only high fat meals, or I'm going to have only high carb, low fat all the time, or only high fat, low carb all the time. Because if I mix them, I'm going to get insulin resistant. I'm going to become insulin. I'm going to gain body fat, et cetera. The other thing to keep in mind is that carbs and fats, and even carbs, fats, proteins, et cetera, they all are used for other things outside of just turning things into fuel or being oxidized or burned to create ATP, burned in quotations, right? So essentially, you have to keep this in mind, that you have different tissues using different substrate for energy as well as for other processes all simultaneously. And so when you take in a meal and you have carbs and fats present in that meal, some of those fats, maybe they go to muscle tissue. Some of those fats, maybe they get used for steroid hormone production. Some of those fats, maybe they go to membrane production. Some of those fats, maybe they get involved in producing different signaling molecules. Well, and it's the same thing with some of those carbs. Maybe they get used for energy. Maybe they get attached to proteins to adjust some proteins can be glycosylated, so you can have carbohydrate groups added to them. So there's a variety of different things that can go on with these substrate besides fuel sources that also adds another layer of nuance to the picture, where it's not as simple as, well, you just don't eat carbs and fats at the same time. Then there's more that gets into this in total energy intake and metabolic dysfunction. That's where the Randall cycle really takes center stage, is when metabolism and metabolic function is dysregulated, like what you see with obesity, type 2 diabetes, insulin resistance, fatty liver, et cetera.
Yeah. And then, so that's kind of the first point, I guess, to digest, is that it's happening at an individual cell basis. And then the next point to cover is that from the bioenergetic perspective, we are trying to influence things in a way that we're oxidizing carbs in favor of fat majority, right? So what are the reasons that we want to be oxidizing the carbs instead of the fats in most cases?
I guess this is actually a really good question, and I think it puts things into context well, because once you determine, okay, well, you know, I'm going to be oxidizing both carbs and fats all the time. Different tissues are going to be using the carbs and fats for different circumstances. But hey, why don't I just use fats instead of carbs? You know, what's the big problem with that? And the thing is, with carb oxidation, there's a variety of benefits over fat oxidation. And it gets into some of the specific mechanisms, but I'm going to give an overview. When you oxidize carbohydrates, you actually produce more NADH in ratio to FADH, which gives you a better NAD plus to NADH ratio altogether because of how that energy NADH is processed at the electron transport chain. Because basically, if you have too much FADH, you lead to a circumstance where all the electrons get coenzyme Q, all of it gets filled up by all the electrons from complex two, and then complex one, which processes NADH, can't function appropriately. It can't drop off the electrons. So you get this pool of NADH that's not getting turned to NAD plus when you're oxidizing fats. And so you get a shifted ratio towards NADH in ratio to NAD plus, whereas with carbs, you get more NAD plus. So this ratio is important because it's a marker of mitochondrial health and metabolic health. So the better NAD plus NADH ratio, and we see this in the biohacking series with people trying to be like, well, I'm going to take this specific form of niacin or this specific form of vitamin B3, nicotinamide mononucleotide or nicotinamide riboside, so that I can have the highest NAD levels, and then they're on a keto diet. You're starting to look, it's like, well, if you just oxidize carbs effectively, you will already have a better ratio NAD plus NADH because the cycling will improve through the changes that happen at the electron transport chain. With this, with carb oxidation, you have less reactive oxygen species inside the mitochondria than fat oxidation, because when you have too much FADH, which happens, or too much in ratio to NADH, which happens with fat oxidation, that buildup of electrons at coenzyme Q and the lack of flow through complex one creates ROS. So you want a circumstance where complex one is working effectively, dropping off electrons at coenzyme Q, so you don't have this ROS buildup. So fat oxidation actually increases ROS, relative to carboxylation inside the mitochondria under normal circumstances. If you are already heavily fat oxidizing fatty acids and you have serious metabolic dysfunction, you try to throw glucose oxidation into that mix, you can actually increase ROS because you start trying to jam more NADH to complex one and it's not working. So that under normal healthy circumstances, carboxylation is superior from an ROS standpoint in the mitochondria. On top of that, carboxylation is more efficient in the sense that you get a better amount of ATP produced per unit of oxygen consumed, because with fat oxidation, the ROS starts to signaling and then the change in the membrane potential in the mitochondria starts to lead to a circumstance where you basically get an uncoupling effect, where the electrons coming in from fat oxidation don't create ATP because of the changes that happen in the electron transport chain. And so you have to consume more oxygen without producing that ATP from fats, where the carbs, you take in the oxygen, you create the ATP, the oxygen's the electron acceptor for the electrons that get dropped off from NADH and FADH2, and then things are okay. So that can also potentially help to decrease oxidative stress because the oxygen is being used effectively instead of having a lot more oxygen needing to be respired and ingested to serve as a final electron acceptor to produce the same amount of ATP because of the uncoupling in fatty acid oxidation. Then on top of this, carbs are important for glutathione production because carbohydrates produce something called NADPH, which is it's a component that is used to recycle glutathione in the cell. It's produced through the pentose phosphate pathway. And when you don't have adequate carbohydrate intake, glutathione production can drop off. So you have a circumstance where you have higher ROS, you have higher oxygen needs, and then you have a decreased glutathione level because you don't have the carbohydrates coming in, which can create a generally higher reactive oxygen species stress. Then on top of that, the carbohydrate produces more CO2. And this, when it's being oxidized first through glycolysis and then in the Krebs cycle and the electron transport chain, the whole process creates more CO2 than you get with fatty acids. This CO2 is really important. It's not a waste product. The CO2 helps the cells uptake oxygen better and get it into the mitochondria effectively, as well as the CO2 improves general circulation. So the higher carbohydrate intake helps to increase CO2 production, which increases the delivery of oxygen to the tissues, which further amplifies mitochondrial function. So it's multiple steps. Carboxylation in it, when things are working well, actually optimizes mitochondrial function across the board compared to fatty acid oxidation. With this, you also have this hormonal overlay. When you don't have enough carbohydrates, you drive stress hormone production, cortisol, adrenaline, glucagon, also growth hormone. Their jobs, or one of their jobs at least, is when you don't have enough carbohydrate coming in, it starts to break down your tissues. Your cortisol will break down the muscle tissue, adrenaline breaks down the fat tissue, glucagon will, it's involved kind of in both, forcing fatty acid oxidation, but increasing the upregulation or the production of glucose from different substrate, particularly amino acids, and then glycerol backbones and lactate, so that you can create glucose because you don't have it coming in. All of those hormones are stress hormones. They're catabolic hormones. Long-term running them is not a great idea. High levels of glucagon are found in type 2 diabetics, people with obesity and impaired glucose tolerance, and then growth hormones directly associated with insulin resistance, cancer, cardiovascular disease, as well as high levels of adrenaline and cortisol. So when you're not having adequate carbs, you are upregulating the same hormonal pathways that are involved in stress and disease processes. They're all disease processes are characterized by these effects, and administering these hormones can actually create the same effects that you see in these disease processes. So long-term administration of growth hormone can drive issues with blood glucose regulation, can drive type 2 diabetes, can drive issues with fatty acid distribution in the tissues. It can also lead to situations like cancer and cardiovascular disease. And you see this with people who have acromegaly, which is basically a pituitary dysfunction where they have a high amount of growth hormone production. You see when you get people synthetic glucocorticoid drugs like prednisone, prednisolone, hydrocortisone, et cetera, that they long-term utilization of these drugs, dexamethasone, can lead to circumstances where they get insulin resistant. They become diabetic. They store fat on their bellies and they start to get high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease. They get bone loss. They get damage to the central nervous system, the brain, the hippocampus, et cetera. So these are all things that it directly is involved in that process. And then again, in certain models, if you knock out glucagon in rats, the signaling of glucagon or its production in diabetic rats, you can actually drastically improve their insulin sensitivity because the glucagon itself can actually inhibit insulin sensitivity. and the utilization of carbohydrate at the peripheral tissues. So not the carbohydrate's job in general lowers all of these hormones because you don't need them, because you're eating, you're the adequate carbohydrate intake basically says to your body, hey, we have enough fuel on board. You don't need to break your tissues down anymore, man. You're good. You have enough of the resources that you need. On top of that, you then, you're not only lowering the stress, but the carbohydrate comes in and it says, tells your thyroid gland, hey, you can start increasing metabolism because we got what we need now. We have a good fuel source coming in, and it increases the liver's conversion of T4 into T3, which is the active thyroid hormone. And then that thyroid hormone then further amplifies mitochondrial function and increases the production of the youth-associated hormones, the steroid hormones like pregnenolone, DHEA, testosterone, progesterone, etc. So you have a circumstance where the carbs in general, when they're oxidized effectively and appropriately, actually improved overall metabolic health. And the thing is, this idea that carbs are causing the metabolic dysfunction, I think, doesn't really hold water. I think what's more, you get this metabolic dysfunction, and then you have difficulty processing the carbohydrates. And you also have difficulty processing the fats, and we'll talk about that. You basically have problems with both substrate across the board because of the metabolic dysfunction happening inside the cell, and everything that's happening in the blood after that is a reflection of what's happening in the peripheral tissues and inside the cells.
Yeah, there's so much there. And I know that that question is like a loaded question that probably deserves like its own episode of why you don't want to be a fat burner and you want to be oxidizing glucose in the majority of cases. But the, you know, when you brought up the NAD supplements, that made me think as well of the low carbers, because they usually, yeah, people who are promoting the NAD supplements are oftentimes on a high fat, low carb diet, which would put them in that situation where they're lacking the adequate NAD, right, to be processing the glucose all the way through the electron transport chain. And then the other thing you mentioned with the glutathione too, is they often recommend doing certain activities or whatever that put like a hormetic stress, right, to like amplify like glutathione and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, they recommend, sometimes they directly recommend taking glutathione, but they also typically recommend supplementing with certain substances that create an oxidative stress to upregulate some of the enzymes that are involved with the production of glutathione and some of the antioxidant enzymes. Whereas adequate carbohydrate in and of itself will allow you to make that glutathione altogether, because the glutathione is recycled by NADPH, which is the NADPH is produced from adequate carbohydrate intake and that carbohydrate running through the pentose phosphate pathway. So if you want to optimize glutathione, you're going to want insulin signaling and carbohydrate so that you can drive that glucose through the pentose phosphate pathway, produce the NADPH, and then produce that glutathione. So this is some of the things where it's like, I'm on board with making sure you have adequate glutathione status. I'm on board with making sure that your NAD plus NADH ratio is optimized. The question is like, how are we going about doing that? Are we going to rely on a bunch of salvage pathways and backup pathways and then taking precursors, but then we're going to drive a circumstance where we're shunting everything towards NADH because we're oxidizing fatty acids? Or are we going to make sure that, yeah, we make sure we have the resource, the adequate B3 status, so we can produce the NAD plus, but then we're actually cycling it appropriately through the mitochondria because you're having adequate carbohydrate and you're oxidizing it effectively, so that you then have a better ratio NAD plus to NADH because it's being cycled appropriately. Instead of looking at this marker saying, hey, better NAD plus NADH ratios are associated with better metabolic outcomes, so let me just plug away these NAD supplements, instead of saying, well, why do we see this in these different organisms who aren't plugging away some of these supplements? Why is that ratio, like, what is that ratio reflective of? So you can still do the supplements, that's fine, but also like make sure the cycling of that is working appropriately through adequate carb oxidation. This is like a nuanced piece, but these are some of the things to think about with carb oxidation in general. And again, this doesn't mean that you then need to go on an entirely carbohydrate diet where you have zero fats. I think fats are still really important in a diet for a variety of reasons. It's just that the primary fuel source that I would say would be optimal to oxidize over the long term would be carbohydrates. And you're going to oxidize some fatty acids no matter what. It's just what proportion are you going to incorporate in your diet for a variety of different metabolic functions. So it's not like, I'm not sitting here saying it's only carbs, no fats. It's like, what's the optimal amount of each thing that we need to optimize our health. And there's going to be some individual adjustments in that based on our physiology and based on our circumstances.
Yeah, yeah. It's just a shift in perspective. So I think we're all after like the same goal, right? Like that these markers are good. It's just how do you get there? And I think that sometimes the low carb people, at least from this perspective, are missing the forest through the trees because there's just easier ways to get there that are much less stressful, right? And like when I came to the perspective in the beginning, it was like, oh, wow, there's this missing piece, you know, that I didn't fully see when I was doing low carb or that I wasn't hearing from any of the low carb people. And when it comes to like CO2, that was one of the big things too. Like CO2 deserves its own episode as well, like with how important that is. And so like you mentioned some of the benefits of the CO2 there too. And then one of the interesting things that I was looking at like in anticipation for this discussion as well too, was like the CO2 also can help protect against like the glycation of in the bloodstream, right too. So after the CO2 is produced, like it has a protective effect from being like reacted with in the bloodstream. No,
the CO2 has interactions with different proteins in the body that change those proteins' effects and also can protect some of the proteins. So it's we see it as a waste product, but it's carboxylation of certain proteins is actually extremely important inside the body. I mean, that's the whole reason you're taking vitamin K2, MK4, MK7 is to optimize carboxylation of a matrix GLA protein. That's one of the major reasons. There's other components, but all together, this is a very important effect inside the body. So CO2 is not a waste product. It does have a variety of beneficial mechanisms inside the body. And people will say like, oh, the CO2, like you see it high in some of these states, like say you have COPD or something like this, but this is not from a cellular production level. This is from a lack of excretion. So the best way to get optimized CO2 production or where you want the CO2 production is at the tissues, because if you have high CO2 concentration at the tissues, it increases the uptake of oxygen at those tissues. And the way you increase CO2 production optimally is you oxidize carbohydrates effectively through mitochondrial respiration at those peripheral tissues, increase your CO2 production from there. And it's kind of a feed forward reaction because you'll produce more CO2, red blood cells will unload that oxygen. Mm-hmm. They'll go back to the lungs, you'll inhale. And then when you inhale, the oxygen will be taken up by the red blood cells and then delivered back to the tissues. And if you have that high CO2, it's this feed forward reaction where it keeps unloading and circling back and unloading the oxygen, circling back, picking it up, unloading, dropping it off. And it keeps moving in this cyclical fashion. Because again, oxygen is absolutely essential in the mitochondria because the oxygen serves that final electron acceptor in the electron transport chain, in the respiratory chain, so that you can actually move the electrons through and produce ATP by pumping the protons across the mitochondrial membrane and creating that membrane potential. So if you don't have oxygen, I mean, that's basically why this is why people suffocate, is it's purely because without the oxygen, the cells don't have the ability to generate energy. And then you basically get complete energy failure and you die. And so that's how essential something like oxygen is. And it directly implicates and shows how important delivery of oxygen to the tissues is, so that you can have that mitochondrial respiration. So and CO2 is important for that, directly important for that, because you can, if you don't have that CO2 production, the RBCs won't, the red blood cells won't drop off the oxygen effectively.
Gotcha. Okay. And then the other thing you were talking about is how the stress hormones and how the carbs and insulin shut that off. So that kind of leads us into insulin, right? Which insulin gets a bad rap from the low carbers as well. So what is insulin's whole role in this thing?
Yeah, so I think insulin gets a bad rap because it's the same type of deals. Like you see insulin present in these states as being high and high in the bloodstream, and it's a marker of metabolic dysfunction. And then there's this conflation that insulin is actually the bad guy, as we hear. But insulin's job is basically a signal of cellular abundance, or a signal that we have carbohydrate coming in. And insulin basically tells the fat tissue, hey, fat tissue, stop releasing free fatty acids, so that because we're going to oxidize carbohydrate. Hey, liver, stop producing glucose because we have glucose coming in from the diet, from the GI tract, and we don't really need to keep producing that glucose. And then, hey, muscle tissue and fat tissue and liver, take up this glucose, refill your stores, refill your bank accounts, make sure that you have adequate amount of reserves. So the fat tissue fills up, with glucose, that gets converted to some fatty acids. And then the muscle tissue fills up with glycogen. Maybe you get some fatty acid deposition. Ideally not under normal circumstances. And then you have the liver will increase your production of glycogen as well inside the liver. So you're replenishing your stores. Now people will think, well, isn't that how I get fat? But here's the thing that you have to understand. Your stores are in constant flux all the time. And what determines how much of your stores, if you store in excess or not, is your energy input versus your energy output. So if you have a high, if your energy input or your energy output are matched, even if you have insulin signaling coming in, and you increase your glycogen or you store a little bit of fat tissue, you're still going to draw at some point in time on those fat stores. You're going to draw down on that. And so you can stimulate insulin and be in a completely normal flux without gaining any type of weight, even though insulin has the anabolic effect, because you're constantly pulling and depositing into your storage tissues all the time, right? If you don't eat, you're going to pull from your fat tissue and you're going to pull on your glycogen stores. So it's how it goes. And we're not eating all day long. You know, you're having 3 or 4 meals a day. Some people maybe 2 meals less, depending on what they're doing. And so you're in a circumstance where when you're not eating, you are drawing down on those accounts. And when you are eating, you are filling them back up. And your body has this mechanism. It's basically a gas tank, so that you don't have to have this constant influx of substrate, which would be unreasonable to have under normal circumstances. Because if you didn't have those stores, you would die. If you don't supply adequate amounts of substrate to the tissues, it's just akin to dying of starvation. You don't have the fuel to actually produce adequate energy. So your muscle tissue serves as a store of amino acids, has its own carbohydrate store, and your fats and your liver serve as a store of energy as well, of fatty acids and also glucose. That glucose from your liver goes to your central nervous system under times where you don't have enough food. And then the fats go to the rest of the body's tissues. When you eat, particularly carbohydrate, the insulin rises, and an insulin turns all that down, reverses those processes, and allows the muscle and fat tissue to take things back up and restock and resupply. Same thing with the liver. So it's actually a beneficial hormone. It has a variety of beneficial effects, including increasing carbohydrate utilization and oxidation and lowering fatty acid oxidation and fatty acid release. The problem when you have metabolic dysfunction is the insulin is elevated because you have this high blood glucose level, but the high blood glucose level isn't just because you're eating carbohydrates. The high blood glucose level is because you are not utilizing those carbohydrates effectively at the cellular level. And there's a lot of components that go into that, but it includes having an overload of fatty acids inside those tissues. And then those tissues are oxidizing the fatty acids, and you get incomplete oxidation of some of those fatty acids in those tissues. That impairs insulin signaling. The cells are overloaded and insulin, they can't respond to the insulin anymore. So then you have this backup of fuel into the blood. They're not responding to the insulin, and you see the high insulin levels. But the insulin itself isn't fundamentally the problem. The insulin is part of the overall dysfunction that you see. That's the problem, is what's going on at the individual cells in terms of their ability to use both fat and carbohydrate, or being overloaded with fats, or whatever the different circumstance is. So the problem, you're seeing all this stuff back up in the blood, and you're trying to say, hey, we see all these cars on the highway. We see the insulin. We see the fats. We see the glucose, you know, these different types of cars. But that doesn't tell you why the highway is jammed up. The highway is jammed up because down at the intersection where you get off, there's a car accident and none of the cars can flow through effectively. That's basically the cells having derangement in the mitochondria.
I see. So the insulin is influencing which substrate the cell is going to burn for the most part, right?
So when you're oxidizing fats, it basically, through a variety of mechanisms, changes in the NADH to NAD plus ratios, changes in the amount of acetyl-CoA, and then it basically buildup of citrate in the cytosol will inhibit pyruvate dehydrogenase and will inhibit complex 1, and it will also inhibit phosphofructose kinase and hexokinase. So the entire glycolytic pathway, as well as the pyruvate dehydrogenase, which brings pyruvate into the mitochondria, as well as complex 1, which is the major electron acceptor for the substrate produced during carboxidation. So it's inhibiting the whole process of carboxidation. What insulin does, insulin comes in, insulin stops the fats from being burned. So it increases something in the cell called malonyl-CoA via increasing an enzyme called acetyl-CoA carboxylase, as well as malonyl-CoA decarboxylase, which both malonyl-CoA decarboxylase degrades malonyl-CoA, and acetyl-CoA carboxylase increases malonyl-CoA. So when you increase acetyl-CoA carboxylase and you decrease malonyl-CoA decarboxylase, you raise total N of malonyl-CoA. That malonyl-CoA shuts down the transporter that brings fats into the mitochondria. So it tells the, it says, we're not burning fats anymore. It's done. We're going to burn carbs now. That allows the electron transport chain to shift so that you can start processing the NADH from carbs through complex one, and you don't have as much FADH going to complex two. So coenzyme Q is hogged. Things start flowing appropriately. Then also pyruvate dehydrogenase can activate because the NAD plus NADH ratio start to shift. The acetyl-CoA content starts to shift, and then things move from there. So insulin, when you're already burning fats and carbs are kind of blocked from being oxidized because of that fatty acid oxidation, insulin comes in and says, hey, chill out on the fats, stops the fats oxidation at multiple levels so that you can allow carbohydrates to come through and be oxidized. And it also limits the release of free fatty acids from the fat tissue, such now that you have the carbs coming in, your body can start to prioritize that carbohydrate oxidation. Because under default states, which this may surprise people in the low carbs tier, under default states, if you're starving, if you're fasting, if you don't eat any carbohydrates, you're going to burn fats. You're not going to be in a circumstance where you're not burning fats. The default substrate when you don't have carbohydrate is going to be burning those fatty acids in general. And insulin's job is to turn that off. When you have the carbohydrates, you can start to oxidize the carbohydrates effectively again. It's just when insulin starts to become, the cells become resistant to the insulin because of the metabolic dysfunction. It's not just because they're like tired of insulin. They're like tired of insulin knocking on the door. That's how it's presented in the sphere. Mm-hmm. That's not exactly what happens. The cells have dysfunction internally, and then they can't respond to insulin effectively because of that internal cellular dysfunction. So that's why it's not working. It's not because it's like, well, we have too much insulin, we've seen too much, so it just stops working altogether. Kind of got fatigued seeing insulin. This guy's kind of pissing me off. I don't want to talk to him anymore. It's not what happens. It's the cells are like, we can't, like, you have it's like you have an animal or a machine that you're working on the farm, right? And the animal's injured or the machine's broken, and you're telling it to plow the field, but it can't walk. So how's the horse gonna plow the field? How's the machine going to plow the field if its tire is flat? It can't do it. That's what's happening with the cell. The cell is having a problem internally, so it can't respond to insulin. It can't do what insulin's telling it to do. That's the fundamental problem. And that's why we want to focus internally in the cell. And the Randall cycle helps us to understand this because it tells us some of the ways in which fatty acids inhibit carb oxidation. And you can kind of reverse engineer some of these processes and look at some of these enzymes to see if you can help to get things functioning again.
Yeah. So what are those first steps that someone does when they're not responding to the insulin? Their cells aren't responding to the insulin and the fuel sources are locked out. And you have old fuel sources on the highway. Nobody's getting in. How does someone start to like break that cycle?
So the biggest thing that occurs in a lot of these states for the vast majority of people that deal with this, fatty liver, type 2 diabetes, impaired glucose tolerance, intolerance, or impaired glucose tolerance, obesity, their cells and their tissues are overloaded with fats. And part of this is because they are not oxidizing the fats. Part of this is because they've gained body fat over time and lost muscle tissue. So their capacity to oxidize the fuel source, as well as the amount of fuel source that they've taken in, has been mismatched for an extended period of time. There could be other reasons, mitochondrial dysfunction from micronutrient deficiencies, mitochondrial dysfunction from stress hormone upregulation, or from microbiome disruption or exposure to different toxins. All these things can impair your ability to produce energy. And if you're taking in the same amount of energy substrate or fuel, you start to build up that fuel. You can start to build up that fuel source altogether. And what happens is when the muscles become overloaded, the liver becomes overloaded with fat, and then the fat tissue is overloaded with fat as well, and it constantly leaks free fatty acids into the bloodstream, where the stress hormones are forcing free fatty acid release into the bloodstream all the time. When you then try to take in the carbohydrate, it leads to a circumstance where you can't use both at the cellular level at the same time, right? And you're being forced to run on those fatty acids, so then it starts to drive oxidative stress. So what you have to do is, if you are holding too much body fat in general, or your body composition has been shifted, so your lean mass is lower and your body fat is high, you have a high deposition of fat in the liver, muscle tissue, things like this, you have to get that stuff out. You have to clear those components out, which is why appropriate resistance training and appropriate weight loss is set up so that you're basically, the engine's flooded with fuel and you're basically allowing the engine to clear itself out by creating an appropriate deficit, as well as setting up appropriate resistance training so the system can clear out, the muscle tissue increases, your capacity to oxidize the fuel increases, and the engine's not flooded anymore. And if you have mitochondrial or function or issues or hormonal issues or microbiome issues or micronutrient issues, et cetera, you want to correct all of those pieces as well so that you can, the fuel that you take in can be converted to energy effectively. So you have your fuel sources and then you have energy. A lot of people think, well, if I have this pizza, it's 100 calories of energy. So I'm getting energy. You're not getting energy. You're getting fuel, and your body has to convert that to energy. If there's something broken in the process, the engine that takes the fuel and turns it into heat or turns it into to energy or movement of the car, well, then no matter how much fuel you shove into the system, you're not going to fix that problem. You have to fundamentally fix what that block is from and the conversion of fuel into energy. And so that's why there's a multiple pieces that can be adjusted there to correct those issues. And a large portion of people are dealing with it because of shift in body composition. Tissues are overloaded or flooded with fatty acids, and they have a constant fatty acid leak. And then this mm-hmm. can lead to a circumstance where they don't process the carbohydrate well. I want to put a side note here. Low-carb, keto, carnivore, intermittent fasting, all type of stuff will improve people's numbers across the board, as well as a caloric deficit, even with carbohydrates present, because it helps to basically deflood the engine. It allows the substrate to start working effectively again because you are pulling back some of the pressure from constantly delivering all this fuel into an engine that's already flooded. So it helps to clear things out, even though it's a high fat diet, even though it triggers some of the stress hormones. So that the downside is that you are running it through some of the stress. But on the flip side, you're actually helping to alleviate some of the stress with these diets because you're decluttering the engine and you're allowing the fuel source to work effectively again. And so that's why whether you're on a high carb, low fat, high fat, low carb, mixed macronutrient diet, you're doing intermittent fasting, but you're taking off excessive amounts of body fat, you see improvement in metabolic markers. So it's not paradox. They all will do this. It's just there's some pros and cons to either side of the spectrum that you have to be aware of when you start running some of these different dietary iterations. But fundamentally, you still have to clear that engine out and make sure it has the resources it needs to function appropriately. And the engine in this case being the mitochondria.
Gotcha. Okay. So step one, I guess, would be to get into some sort of caloric deficit, right? And then make sure you're hitting all the little, like the micronutrients and stuff like that, that are cofactors for the energy production through the diet. But then the other component probably is the macronutrient ratios, right? So when you're thinking about setting up somebody's macronutrient ratios, like carbs to fat and stuff like that, I assume you want the higher ratio of carbs, but when you're setting the fat intake, is it on a sliding scale kind of based on somebody where somebody's at with the insulin resistance or their metabolic function in general? Like with somebody who has higher body fat and maybe releasing more free fatty acids, does that mean that they can get away with, and it actually may be better for them to have less of an intake of fats in general? Than somebody who doesn't have that level of free fatty acids flooding the bloodstream?
So basically the first thing is set up your caloric intake, make sure you're in that deficit. I usually like 20%, right? That's usually where I start because you see consistent weight loss without feeling terrible. So you have enough weight loss and you have a reasonable amount of weight loss and a reasonable amount of time. So if you go lower, it's going to take forever and then you won't stick to it. But if you go higher, you may feel pretty terrible. Sleep, mood, energy all start to take a dip. Now, the next thing you want to do, and this is really important before we get to carb versus fat ratios, is you need to make sure your protein intake is solidified, 0.64 to 0.82 grams per pound. Why?
Okay.
Essentially, the protein is going to maintain that lean muscle tissue. Again, your muscle tissue is one of the major sources for insulin sensitivity, where basically carbohydrate is pushed into via insulin. So the lower muscle mass you have, the lower lean tissue you have in general, and a large portion of our lean tissue is muscle mass by weight, what you wind up seeing, or most people it's muscle mass, but you can have people with obesity that can have quite a bit of fat tissue as well. But if the muscle tissue will allow you, like if your muscle tissue stays high, you'll be able to process more substrate in general, especially once things work better. So if you take your muscle tissue off when you lose the weight, you could still wind up being in a circumstance where now you're just skinny fat, or maybe you're just skinny in general and your total intake has to drop. And this is where you see with people who run Ozempic, they start to look a little bit gaunt or frail when they finish losing the weight because they lost quite a bit of muscle tissue And that's still a bad place to be, because say your proportion of fat tissue, muscle tissue is the same, you could still deal with metabolic issues even though you took the fat tissue up. So protein needs to stay high. Resistance training is also helpful to make sure, it doesn't have to be hard resistance training either, but to make sure that you maintain that muscle tissue throughout the deficit as you take off the body fat. Because again, the goal is to just take off the body fat, not to take off any of the other lean tissue, your bone mass, your muscle tissue, etc. Now, after you figure out your protein intake, I then go to fat intake. If somebody's already low carb, they may want to start on the higher end. I usually shoot between 20 to 30% of calories, and then figure out from the 30% of calories where they can fit in from there. Do they titrate down to 25? Do they go down to 20? Do they feel better or closer to 30? Kind of stay from there. If they were like 60%, 70% fat, then they're probably going to want to progressively decrease their fat intake downwards. Maybe you go 70 to 60 to 50 to 40 to 30. Because just like when you go through keto and you drop all the carbs and you force fat oxidation, when you come out of low carb, you have an adaptation period, right? People have the keto flu from dropping carbs. When you bring carbs back on board, there is an adaptation to reintroducing those carbs, because your body has to now get used to processing the carbohydrate because it's been running on the fatty acids. So there's adjustments in digestion. There's adjustments at the cellular level. There's adjustments at the pancreas and at the liver. So these things have to be done. I would do it progressively and appropriately so you don't just start slamming tons of carbs on board and running into a variety of different problems. Once you determine your fat intake, you then determine your carb intake. And the carb intake fills up the rest of your caloric target from there. So if you did 30, you know, if you're doing like 20% fat, you'd get more carbs. You do 30% fat, you have a little bit less carbs. With this in mind, somebody who is very insulin resistant, to try to help improve insulin sensitivity, there's the deficit, there's the adequate protein intake, and then there's, I will try to bring fat intake towards the lower end, because higher carb, lower fat intake helps to improve insulin sensitivity in a variety of studies. But you got to be careful with your carb sources here, because if they're not tolerating carbs, you can't flood the system. You can't try to throw nitrous on a flooded engine by dropping in fruit juice, maple syrup, and honey. You got to take it easy, and you got to go with the whole fruit sources so that the system gets a nice supply of carbs in a reasonable fashion that doesn't overwhelm the liver, pancreas, and then the peripheral tissues, which are already struggling. So you want to lower the energy intake, and then you could try to keep a higher carb, a little bit lower end of fat, and maybe you could throttle protein, because in people with impaired glucose tolerance or type 2 diabetes, the higher branched chain amino acids and some of the amino acids like alanine and whatnot can stimulate gluconeogenesis. And so you can throttle the protein intake a little bit, and that can also help to improve insulin sensitivity as well. So these are some of the strategies that you can use. At the end of the day, though, adjusting it to your personal context is important. So you play around within those targets and see how you feel. Do I do better with 0.64 or 0.82 grams of protein? Do I do better with 30% fat, or do I do better with 20% fat? And then what type of carb source do I use? Do I tolerate saturated fats better than monos, or do I do better with monos or kind of a mix? So you play around with these components, because I can't emphasize enough, there's a lot of individualization in this process, where like your diet, Ethan, is massively different than my diet, just because our bodies are different, our backgrounds are different, digestion's a little bit different, et cetera. So this is something that's really important to keep in mind as well.
Yeah. It's not massively different. It's somewhat similar, but there are some nuances. Yeah. That kind of leads me into my next question, was around like the types of fats, because you have like coconut oil, which is S tier level fat, according to the Petosphere. And I know it's metabolized differently, right? Like everyone talks about how it's metabolized more like a carbohydrate source than other fat sources. So is there a benefit to that? How do you think about kind of organizing the fat sources?
So the fat sources there's a lot of nuance with the fats. The thing about coconut oil is, for some people, it can really irritate their intestine, because the medium chain triglycerides can be irritating, and they also have some minor antimicrobial effects. The other thing is the coconut oil rapidly is digested and absorbed because it's mostly medium chain fat, so it doesn't need bile acids, and it goes to the liver right away. And then the MCTs can be oxidized pretty rapidly because the MCTs don't actually need to be brought into the mitochondria through carnitine palmitoyl transferase 1, because the short chain fatty acids can perfuse across the cell membranes. And so this leads to a circumstance where if your mitochondria are already struggling, and then you try to throw in some of this substrate, it could put some pressure on the mitochondria. So some people, depending on what they have going on the liver, can find that they have pressure from coconut oil and they may not tolerate it well. Because on the flip side, if you're stuck in a circumstance where you're oxidizing tons of polyunsaturated fats, or you've been eating a lot of those, the coconut oil can actually be helpful in that circumstance because it can help to minimize some of the oxidative stress going on at the liver and different tissues. So there's kind of a mixed bag with coconut oil, and depending on if the person's going to tolerate it very well or not, because it is oxidized rapidly, but it's also highly saturated, and in a system that's already having difficulty oxidizing fats, throwing something in there that's going to force zone oxidation can put pressure on it. It's like having tons of free fructose as well. If you just start smashing slushies and you already have metabolic dysfunction, probably not going to go well, even though it's carbohydrate, because you're going to get a rapid ingestion of fructose to the liver in a high amount that may put pressure on the liver. It's already struggling. And the fructose, like unlike glucose, will enter the cell and can start to be oxidized pretty rapidly. There's not really as much inhibition on it with glucose. So that's part of the concern. And again, this is not that fructose is bad or coconut oil or MCTs are bad. It's just, you have to understand the context in which you're throwing that fuel source. It's like, if again, you're in Fast and Furious, you're driving an old beat up car with a crapped out engine, and you're like, oh, let me just put some nitrous on this thing. It's like, it's not going to go well. The engine's not going to handle it, and neither is the car. So you want to have a circumstance where those things can be helpful, but you want to have a circumstance where the engine is metabolizing things effectively with some of the substrate, or else you can create new issues.
Gotcha. Okay. So right now we have the 20% caloric deficit, emphasis on the protein to start. So you want the 0.64 to 0.08 grams per pound of body weight, because that's the most metabolically active tissue, right? For fats, you're shooting between 20 to 30%. And there's some individuality in the sources there. And then you're filling up the rest with the carbohydrates. And there's going to be individuality with the carbohydrate sources as well, too. And then yes, if people want to use your calculator, you have the energy-based diet calculator in the description below. So you could quickly grab the numbers for that there. The next question that I have in the food guide, the next question I have there, too, is around like, so you want, there's these cofactors, right, that are necessary for the oxidation of the fuel sources, fats and carbs, right? But is there any ones that are like stick out to you, you know, as like we ought to be hitting these like B vitamins or whatever to make sure that we're assisting in pushing towards carb oxidation versus fat oxidation?
So I would say all the energy Bs are absolutely essential for carb oxidation. But some of the major ones are going to be your vitamin B3. Vitamin B2 can be important, and also vitamin B1, because B1 activates pyruvate dehydrogenase, and an FADH2 and NADH are dependent upon vitamin B2 and then vitamin B3 respectively. So you want to have those to make sure things are running well. And then also calcium, magnesium can activate PDH, pyruvate dehydrogenase, which brings the pyruvate from glycolysis into the mitochondria. So that you can then convert that pyruvate, which is basically the whole glucose oxidation pathway, into the NADH, FADH2, which goes to electron transportation and drives ATP production. So you're going to want to have calcium, magnesium, B1, B2, B3, then B5, B7 are important for other components inside the mitochondria in general. So you want to have adequate amounts of pretty much all of the energy B vitamins across the board. Those are going to be absolutely essential for carbohydrate oxidation. And then for general mitochondrial protection, adequate glutathione, vitamin C, vitamin E, as well as adequate mineral status for manganese, copper, zinc, and iron is absolutely essential, because those are involved with basically protecting the mitochondria from oxidative stress, because those are cofactors for the different enzymes like catalase, glutathione peroxidase, the thioredoxins, superoxidase mutase, etc. So you want to have the minerals dialed in to mop up the reactive oxygen species at the mitochondria, as well as the vitamins like vitamin C, vitamin E. Adequate CoQ10 intake is important as well, because that is what you use to make coenzyme Q to transfer electrons from complex 1 and complex 2 to complex 3. So it's really, you want the whole the whole complement of micronutrients to make sure that the cells have everything they need to function appropriately. And you also, there's some things where it's not just getting enough, it's also not getting too much. Because if you do overload on iron, you can drive oxidative stress, which will basically create ferroptosis, which is the cellular suicide because of excess iron-induced oxidative stress. So you want to make sure that you're like in optimal ranges for zinc, for copper, for iron, and your B vitamins you want to have dialed in, because too much of some things can actually be problematic, put pressure on different systems depending on how high you're going.
Yeah.
So it's really getting the complement in that Goldilocks zone, those optimum ranges.
I knew before I asked you that question that it was going to be, you kind of want everything, because it's never just one thing. So yeah, you can find all the different food sources too that can help you hit those things in the food guide as well. And then, kind of go from there. And then also the email series that comes with it's pretty nice too, because you get to like really dial in the certain components in the diet. So my recommendation, everybody download your chronometer and start getting all the little things green in the micronutrient section and go from there. So one other question that I had was like that. So that kind of setup was in the context of somebody who's maybe struggling with the insulin resistance. For somebody who is metabolically healthy and feels a little bit better with like a higher fat intake, like what do you think is like the upper limit for somebody? Could they do like a 20% protein, 40% carbs, 40% fat? Is that like a reasonable ratio, or like where do you cap it?
I think for me, the upper end would be 40% fat. The absolute upper end. And I think when you have guys who have high muscle mass and have high activity levels, sometimes it's easier to hit your macronutrient targets and your caloric targets with a bit higher fat. For me, I'm closer to 30%. I do better with that, but that's because the workout volume altogether increases with the higher muscle mass, increases the fat oxidation in the muscle tissue at rest. So this can shift things, and some guys will find that androgens are better on a little bit higher fat intake.
Mm.
So I'd say 40% is probably the upper end that I would go with. Most people I'm working with fall between 20 to 30%. And in somebody who's coming out of low carb and transitioning, I will titrate fats down and titrate carbs upwards, depending on how they feel and how their lab values are moving, to get them within an optimal range and make sure things are functioning well. So that's basically those are, I guess, rough targets or guidelines that people can think about when they're structuring their diet.
Okay. With the sugar diet, right, the bringing fat like to the bottom of the barrel is a pretty popular trend right now as a way to correct for insulin resistance. My metabolic function is so bad. I'm so insulin resistant. I don't even want like any competition for a substrate at the cell. I just want to do everything in my power to promote glucose oxidation. Why not just bring my fat to as low as possible? What I guess is the other side to that.
Yeah, so a couple things will happen. It doesn't happen right away. It's not going to happen in one day. But it does happen progressively if you keep running really low fat intake. First things first, your satiety will suck because the fat delays gastric emptying. The next thing is your blood sugar will probably be up and down all over the map, because you're going to have to eat very frequently to make sure that your blood sugar is maintained. Because when you just have the carbs, it's going to come up and come down, especially since protein is low. So blood sugar is going to come up and come down quickly. Then on top of this, over time, you won't stimulate bile acid release. And without the bile acid release, you won't be able to clear out the small intestine bacteria. You won't be able to trigger intestinal motility, because the bile acids do trigger intestinal motility. You will put pressure on the liver. You won't be able to detoxify the liver, because the liver takes the fatty acids and basically, or takes its metabolites that is broken down, puts in the bile acids, shoot them into the intestine. Fiber binds the bile acids and pulls things out. And then on top of that, the fats can be helpful for steroid hormones. So if your fat intake gets too low, you can fall into a circumstance where you start to see an impact on libido or on your cycle, for women, your cycle, things like this. So doing that too long can put pressure on the system and create some of these problems altogether. And you can also, with the digestive, you can develop SIBO and some of these issues, especially because in the sugar diet, you're running really high carb intake. That's very refined sources that are extremely carb dense. So some people will develop these issues. The other thing is if you have some metabolic dysfunction and you start to push fat really low and you have carbs really high from these sources, you can also bump up triglycerides in some people who are sensitive to it. And if they get too high, they can put pressure on your pancreas and you can irritate it, maybe a little pancreatitis. So you got to be careful doing some of those things, because the fats are quite important altogether from that standpoint.
So the next question I have is related to metabolic flexibility. So you hear a lot of different influencers on YouTube and whatnot talk about metabolic flexibility, and I'm still a little confused as to like what that actually means. So I'd love to give like your definition of metabolic flexibility, and then the part two to that question would be for people who say it's important to like exercise the ability to oxidize both like fuel substrates. Like I maybe do some keto days and I do some high carb days. That way, you know, my cellular, it's like working it out, right? Like it doesn't get rusty or something like this. Like, what are your thoughts around that?
So metabolic flexibility is, at least in this, the general definition and even the ideas within the research, is the ability to be to switch between oxidizing fuel sources, whether carbs or fats. Now, the idea that you need to go to a really high fat day with low carbs so that you can be able to oxidize fats and optimize metabolic flexibility, I think is pretty questionable, because if you don't eat, if you fast overnight, if you don't have any carbs in general, you will start to oxidize fats because you only have so much stores of carbohydrate and you only have so much gluconeogenesis going on. So in any state that you don't eat carbohydrates on a consistent basis, you will start to increase fatty acid oxidation as a rule. The default state without adequate carb intake is going to be fatty acid oxidation. People say, well, people with diabetes and obesity, they can't oxidize fats well. It's like they can't oxidize anything well. They're not oxidizing carbs and they're not oxidizing fats well because they have mitochondrial dysfunction. But in general, if they don't eat carbohydrate overall, they will still force fatty acid oxidation, and they're already stuck in a state where they are partially or improperly or in general oxidizing fatty acids and having a difficult time oxidizing carbohydrate. They get stuck oxidizing carbs, and then they get stuck oxidizing fats. The carbs get thrust through the pentose phosphate pathway, hexosamine biosynthetic pathway, and then also they get stuck running through a lactic acid fermentation where the pyruvate gets converted to lactate to recycle some of the NAD. So you're in a circumstance where metabolic dysfunction is characterized in general: stress, starvation, low carb diets, fasting, trauma, illness. All of this is characterized by increased fatty acid oxidation as a rule. So you're like, you don't need to go eat a high fat diet to make sure that those systems work, because they're going to work if you don't eat in general. So that it'll be the state that you run into. When you have what you want to be able to do is oxidize that carbohydrate. So if you're oxidizing carbs right now, it's your primary source in general, because you're eating a relatively higher carbohydrate diet. When you stop eating, you'll still oxidize carbs. You'll be oxidizing fats overnight if you have a 12-hour, 14-hour fast from just sleeping and in between meals. So it's a weird thing to state that you need. It doesn't make sense fundamentally to say you need to burn fats so that you have metabolic flexibility, because you will always burn fats if you're not eating or under any circumstance where you have high amounts of stress or illness or you're not taking in carbohydrates. And then again, people with metabolic dysfunction, they are stuck burning fats to a large extent, and maybe they're not burning them well, but they're also not burning glucose or any of these other components well either, because they have this mitochondrial dysfunction going on.
Okay, so we were talking about insulin earlier and how like insulin's not really the bad guy, but you do have in these states where someone is insulin resistant, like you were talking about how the pancreas is constantly putting out insulin all the time. So what are the damaging effects that we can see with that going on?
So basically, when you have the high blood glucose levels and the high free fatty acids, which is what you see in these states, because the cells aren't metabolizing the carbohydrate or the fats effectively, or they're potentially stuck oxidizing fats, even if it's improper or incomplete oxidation, what winds up happening is you have the substrate move back into the blood, right? So you get a buildup on that highway of carbs and fats, because you have that car crash down at the intersection or at the exit. Now, this puts pressure on the pancreas because the pancreas is sensing the high carbohydrate levels in the blood and is saying, wait, I need to put out insulin. So it keeps trying to put out the insulin. The insulin's also not being taken up by the cells as well, because the insulin is taken up and degraded inside the cell once it has its response that binds to the receptor. And then the pancreas sees this constant high blood glucose and is trying to put out that insulin to manage it. And eventually there's only so much insulin the pancreas can produce and export at one period of time. So it starts to create damage and oxidative stress inside the pancreas. So the pancreas eventually, it basically becomes fatigued, overworked. And then the pancreas over time, because it can't keep up with the demand, starts to break down and starts to have problems producing the insulin. And that's where you see late stage type 2 diabetes, where the pancreatic beta cells that produce insulin become basically non-functional. They aren't producing insulin anymore from that damage. So this also creates, when we're looking at blood glucose spike, people say, oh, your blood glucose spikes up, then you release insulin. And over time, like, your cells become fatigued and your pancreas becomes fatigued. And then now that your pancreas will fail, your cells will fail. And it's like, not necessarily. When you have a circumstance where you eat carbohydrates and you have the glucose spike and that your pancreas is supposed to put out insulin, that's its job. It's like, I have a basketball player, but I'm never going to let him play basketball on the court because, God forbid, he plays basketball, he'll get tired. That's like the rationale that people are coming up with this perspective where you never want to have any insulin release or increase in blood glucose. It's supposed to happen. It's just, if you take that basketball player, you take that pancreas and you force him to play for 48 hours straight and you don't give him any breaks, then yeah, he's going to fail. So under normal circumstances where you have carbohydrate, the blood glucose rises, then the pancreas puts out insulin to shift everything. That's normal. That's fine. Blood glucose comes back down. Things are going okay. Things are functioning well. It's only when you have the circumstance where it's chronically elevated that it beats up on the pancreas, on top of the fact that you are driving oxidative stress in that state because you have this metabolic dysfunction happening centrally at the cell through the forcing of having both substrates flooding the system. So if you have the oxidative stress from there, then on top of this, and something else to point out is the vasculature. The vasculature gets it's being hammered by the oxidative stress from the general body state, having a hard time metabolically. And then it's getting both glucose and fats in high concentrations all the time because you're supposed to have it acutely, right? It's another weird thing. It's like, we don't want glucose. We don't want fatty acids in the vasculature. It's like your vasculature is literally meant to transport these substrates to the tissues. It's its job. It's like, God forbid we have any cars run on the highway because, you know, if they drive on the highway, they're going to damage the highway. So we can't ever have anybody drive on the highway. It's like, well, the highway was built for the cars to drive on in the first place. It's just what type of cars are driving, how much traffic, how long is that traffic there, and what does that traffic do to the roads itself? Under normal circumstances, the road should be fine. It's just if you start having car crashes all over the road and you damage the dividers and you know, you have an engine fire or whatever, like, yeah, that will damage the highway. But under normal circumstances, things should function appropriately. But when you have this dysfunction, you basically have fires all along the highway. And then you have the cars are stuck idling on the highway long term. So the insulin and fats are sitting in the blood, and the fires plus the cars sitting there creates damage to that highway, to that vasculature. And that's where you start seeing like endothelial dysfunction, the cardiovascular progression, damage to the vasculature in and of itself. And that's where you see long-term diabetes. You get the microvascular complications where you essentially have damage to the eyes, damage to the kidneys, damage to the peripheral nerves, and also damage to the or inability to heal because you don't have that good circulation anymore. You're not supplying the substrate very well, or the cells are unable to take it up. And then the skin can't do its functions. The kidney can't function appropriately. The vasculature is getting damaged. The eyes are getting damaged. And so it's this metabolic dysfunction is driving all the creating some of these problems. And also these tissues are dealing with the metabolic dysfunction themselves. So you have the backup will damage the circulatory system. Each the cells individually are being damaged by this metabolic state and the high oxidative stress from being stuck with both substrate, having the engine flooded. And then now you're starting to see everything back all the way up. And then the pancreas is just there. It's trying to cope, but it can't. And eventually over time, it'll cope for quite some time, but over time it starts to fail. And that's where you see the decreased production of insulin over the long term with type 2 diabetes. So it's basically like this progressive effect of metabolic dysfunction, the flooding of the mitochondria in the fuel sources, the fuel supply being mismatched to the energy out to the energy output, leading to this backlog across the system. And it just progressively worsens over time, unless you again, you change the diet, change the lifestyle, correct the individual problems going on to minimize those issues.
Mm-hmm. Is there any way someone can test whether or not they're oxidizing glucose or fatty acids, like at a given point in time? Like, is there a lab test or is there something they can do like at home, or is it really kind of just going by subjective feeling?
No, there's a variety of things you can check. One of the biggest ones is going to be a respiratory quotient, which mm-hmm. basically looks at the cellular production of CO2 in ratio to how much oxygen is taken up. So there are devices that will give you a respiratory quotient. I don't think people need to do this. Then you can also look at blood testing and see where your glucose, where your insulin, where your C-peptide, where your hemoglobin A1C is. You can look at a HOMA IR. You can look at what's going on with your lipid panel. You can look at all these markers, the inflammatory markers, kind of get a gauge what's going on with the vasculature. You're seeing what's going on with the pancreas. And you can try to gauge from that by itself, especially if you're eating carbs, if the system's working well. You can also, there's tests like the Dutch, like an oat test, excuse me, where you can look at the organic acids and get a gauge based on the organic acids, how the Krebs cycle's working to a large extent, which can give you an idea of what's going on with the electron transport chain. And then Chris Masterjohn also has there's mito swab. And the mito swab is basically a cheek sample of your mitochondria that give you an idea of how the different respiratory chains are working to some extent and some of the different enzymes like citrate synthase. So you can look at that as well and get a rough idea of what's going on inside the mitochondria. Chris has produced a report, the mito.me report. There's some things about it because it like breaks things down in like very discrete ways, which sometimes I think can be confusing for some people because I have clients who've done it. But overall, the mito swab and the mito.me report, those things can give you an idea of what's going on in the mitochondria. An oat test can give you an idea. And then also you can look at different blood testing markers as well to see how things are going, as well as looking at a respiratory quotient. You don't have to do all these things, but these are ways to like really get in the weeds and see what's going on at the cellular level with your oxidation of different fuel sources and conversion to ATP and energy.
Gotcha. And if someone wanted to get those tests, but they don't know like the correct ranges or anything and how to like interpret them, with you working with clients, you're doing that for them in the one-to-one, and then there's the group coaching program. Are you also looking at people's labs and stuff like that in the coaching program as well?
As long as people are okay with me looking at their looking at their health information, then yeah, I do it inside the group coaching program, and also on a one-on-one basis, I look at the mito swab reports, I'll look at the oat test, I look at all these blood markers, and whether they're doing the group coach or the coaching program or whether they're doing one-on-one, I still look at all these different components, help people to make sense of it, and then figure out what the next steps are. What do they need to do when they get those results?
Yeah, I just remember always like wanting to get tests, but then going like, when I get this back, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to make anything out of this, like what to do. So I think finding someone who can interpret it appropriately is just as important as getting it actually tested. So, out of questions. I think we covered a lot. It's an interesting topic just because it's so central to like the bioenergetic paradigm, right? Like wanting to be a glucose burner and the Randall cycle being like a central component of how you shift things in that direction. So it was fun like revisiting this and learning about the different enzymes and stuff like that all over. So I appreciate that. But is there anything else I guess you want to say before we jump off?
Yeah, I'd recommend that we just made two videos. One, putting the Randall cycle in context for what people are going to do with their diet and answering questions like, can you have carbs and fat at the same time? And I also made a new video going through the mechanisms, both sides of the Randall cycle, the glucose inhibition of fatty acid oxidation and the fatty acid inhibition of glucose oxidation. I made that video as well. So I recommend people check that out because I think between these three videos, this podcast, and in those two videos, I think people can really get a good understanding of the Randall cycle. And if they want to take it to another level on my Mike Fave Science channel, I do have two. They're like really long lectures. I think they're like an hour and change a piece, going through both legs of the different cycles and really getting into the what's going on at the enzymatic level. For both of them. So you can also check those out as well. So there's a lot of different areas where I've talked about the Randall cycle. The new mechanistic one that we're going to release here, that I think that one is pretty concise and really goes into it, the mechanisms as well, and helps to describe what's going on in the mitochondria and the electron transport chain at the Krebs cycle, and then what's going on in the cytosol. And I kind of bring it in with how insulin plays a role, and then what that means when you back up into the bloodstream. I think I'd really recommend checking those videos out, because at least between these three videos, I think you could really help people understand. And that's the goal, is that people can understand the cycle, try to make sense of it, see how it relates to them, and start to understand, you know, how they, like what recommendations to focus on to improve their health. So I would recommend checking those out.
Yeah. Yeah. And then one thing that while you were saying, is I just was thinking of this, like there's a lot of talk about like not tracking and, you know, don't be a calorie counter or whatever. And from a practical perspective, like if you are worried about the Randall cycle, just taking like a couple days and logging your food into chronometer and seeing where you land, like on some of the ratios, would be interesting. And then, you know, you may be surprised, see if you fall within some of the numbers that were talked about here on the podcast. And then if you want to dial it in further, just go get the energy-based food guide and calculator. And then you could have like the custom numbers and like try that for a few days, see if you feel any difference, and go from there.
I think it's just weird that people are like, I don't want to look at my energy intake and I don't want to look at my macro breakdown, but I have a metabolic problem. It's if it's like, I want, my car is not driving well, but I don't want to know how much fuel's in the gas tank. And I don't want to really know what's going on under the hood. I think when you have a circumstance, when there's, I understand people get like fatigued to that stuff, but when you have a circumstance where you're having metabolic problems, you want to look at your total energy intake and you want to look at what your fuel sources are, so that you can start to understand why you have that energy problem. Then it's actually exceptionally important, because when you look at the research, when you unload these tissues through deficit, through different means, when you take off the extra fat and you decrease your total body fat, maintaining your muscle mass, and you decrease the fat stores at the liver, at the muscle tissue, et cetera, you have a circumstance where things start to work better because the engine's not flooded. And that comes down to your total energy intake and also the substrate that you're providing, the fuel sources that you're providing. So it's important to actually look at those things. That's why we made the energy-based diet calculator and the food guide. It's entirely for free. So the new calculator helps people to figure out maintenance, or they need surplus or deficit to lose the weight, so that people can, you know, regardless of whatever they do, they can start to get some hard numbers to make progress and see how things will improve for them. So I recommend checking that out as well, because I think it's a free resource. There's, you know, there's no cost to it at all, and it will help you to start to set things up and start to improve things from a metabolic standpoint.
I think it's because of like a lot of these people that we speak to and who are in the nutrition world and everything like that, and are coming around to this perspective, were doing the calorie counting when they were in low carb or when they were trying to lose weight. And it's from a different frame. Like it's from the perspective of like restricting calories and stuff like that to be able to move things down on the scale. And a lot of the times that ended up burning those people. So then when you shift to a new perspective and it's like, do I want to bring back out the food calculator? There's a knee jerk reaction there to be like, no, I don't want to do it. But what I would challenge people, or like, well, I would advise like maybe shifting it, your perspective is like, you're not doing it from a place of restriction. You're doing it from a place of like, I'm trying to hit my needs here. Like I'm actually calorie counting to make sure I'm getting adequate protein, to make sure I'm getting enough carbs in relation to the protein, to make sure I'm hitting fats and certain micronutrients and everything like that. And when you start thinking of it like that, and then also you feel better while you're doing it, and things start to trend in the right direction, like on lab numbers and stuff like that, it's motivating. And I know people that we speak to in the coaching program and stuff like that have actually found that they enjoy the tracking now, whereas before they were really opposed to it. So everybody can do whatever they want, but you know, that's my two cents.
I think the previous I think people were finding that it wasn't working for them. And I think the previous paradigm was just entirely focused on calories, calories in, calories out. Yeah. And there's that, like, that's one of the early paradigms you go through in nutrition. But basically in this circumstance, the calories and the macros are just to figure out how much gas do you need in the tank for your outcomes. That's it. Just so you can get a sense of like roughly how much food do I need to have to achieve my goal. And then also when you learn how you can adjust your macros and your energy intake and your diet to achieve particular goals, and you actually watch it happen, like, oh, this actually makes way more sense now. And I'm not just spinning my wheels. I'm actually getting the outcomes that I want. And I think that's kind of difference. That's why people in the program, like, I don't really want to put my stuff in chronometer. And then they're on the calls with us every day. And we're showing them, oh, you can make this adjustment here in chronometer. You can change your diet this way. You can make this adjustment. Like, oh, I slept through the night. Oh, my blood glucose is stable. Oh, I'm losing that 1 pound per week now where I wasn't before. And I'm eating carbs, or my digestive problems stopped. And they start to see, oh, you can actually really heavily maneuver the diet to get a variety of different outcomes. Then that's when I think people, they see the change and they see how valuable it is. But it's like the calorie stuff that you see before, like, you know, when you look at calories in like the traditional mainstream sense, it's like eat this cardboard filled Weight Watchers chicory fiber product that's only a 1 point or something like this. It's like just eat nothing that has no nutrition at all, that just is fiber, so it's filling, so that you can have low points for your Weight Watcher stuff, but it doesn't necessarily help you to target any of the other components for micronutrient density, figuring out which foods work for your system, dialing in your microbiome, and then making sure that metabolic function is improving and the weight is moving on the scale, not just because you're eating, you know, these chicory bars or whatever the thing is. So I think this stuff is it's a big shift from that. And I think it's important that people just see calories and macros are just tools. They just help us get our outcomes. They help us to see what we need for our bodies, for our body, and help us to quantify it so that we can make these specific adjustments and get the outcomes instead of using them as this straitjacket for things. So there's a lot of play and movement and adjustments. And when you start to learn how to use the tools effectively, it's actually really fun. It's like the first time you start, you ask ChatGPT a question, like we were just talking about this. It's like your mom was telling your brother he couldn't use ChatGPT for his homework. Yeah. And then she started using ChatGPT for some of her stuff. And she's like, wow, this thing is awesome. It's the same thing when you get some of these other tools down pat. You start to realize, hey, like this stuff can actually be really helpful if it's used appropriately and I think about it in the correct context. If you think about AI, where it's like going to replace all of your stuff and you're not going to use critical thinking, like, yeah, it's probably not good. But if you use it to optimize, you know, maybe it helps you do menial tasks so that you can really focus on high level stuff. Well, then that's very different. And the outcomes are very different from it. It's the same thing with calories and macros. So I think that's I think that's an important piece here. And I do think a lot of people are kind of burnt on it. And I understand even with low carb, a lot of people like, because you don't have to track. You just eat fat and protein and that's it. And then the weight comes off.
Or the sugar diet, right?
Diet. Yeah. That's the selling point, right? Is that you don't have to think about it. You just slam sugar. You just slam fat. But I do think getting a hold of these things helps you to get a more balanced and sustainable approach that you can run into the long term and make improvements across the board instead of just seeing the weight go down, but having other things worsen and then run from there. So we're trying to get total and complete health while seeing the body composition shift. And so in order to do that, we're going to need some more tools than just blunt metrics of I just don't eat carbs or I just don't eat protein and fat.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, we covered a lot there and I think we can put a bow on it if there's anything. Yes, so where can people find you?
People can find me at my website, mikefave.com. And of course, they can find me on the YouTube channel, Mike Fave YouTube, and on the podcast, Mike Fave Podcast. Yeah. What about you, Ethan?
Okay. Nice. Here on the Mike Fave Podcast, sometimes on Twitter, sometimes on Instagram. You never know. So I guess we'll catch everybody next week.
Yep. Catch you in the next video, everyone. Take care.
All right.